I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. If you saw the movie When Harry Met Sally, there was this wry, sexy exchange in a restaurant, and a customer observing this exchange says, "I'll have what she's having." I can't remember the detailed plot of that movie, but I remember that scene, and that's what drew us to this new book by one of the great writers on film, David Thompson, our guest. The book's called Moments That Made the Movies. Our producers lined up lots of audio clips for you to hear and to hear them, to see how Thompson perceives a particular scene in a great movie is a fascinating experience, though he's the first to admit you might have other scenes that you love from a much-loved film. David Thompson has written many books on the movies. He's the film critic for The New Republic. Welcome to the show, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's get right to it. The year 1989, the movie When Harry Met Sally, directed by Rob Reiner, written by the late Nora Ephron, and our two main characters, Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal. Would you set this up for us?
Well, they're in a delicatessen, and throughout the film, really, they have this bickering romantic relationship. They have great deal of difficulty settling to each other, and the topic of conversation that comes up is whether sometimes in sexual encounters people pretend to be having the kind of fulfillment and satisfaction that the other person in the relationship would like to think they're having. And Sally, Meg Ryan, does an orgasm on the spot, so to speak.
So what do you do with these women? You just get up out of bed and leave?
Sure.
Well, explain to me how you do it. What do you say?
Just have an early meeting, early haircut, early squash game.
You don't play squash.
They don't know that. They just met me.
That's disgusting.
I know. I feel terrible.
You know, I'm so glad I never got involved with you. I just would have ended up being some woman you had to get up out of bed and leave at 3 o'clock in the morning and go clean your andirons. And you don't even have a fireplace. Not that I would know this.
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
Hey, I don't feel great about this, but I don't hear anyone complaining.
Of course not. You're out the door too fast.
I think they have an okay time.
How do you know?
I mean, how do I know? I know.
Because they...
Yes, because they...
How do you know that they're really...
What are you saying, that they fake orgasm?
It's possible.
Get out of here.
Why? Most women at one time or another have faked it.
Well, they haven't faked it with me.
How do you know?
Because I know.
Oh. Right. That's right. I forgot. You're a man.
What is that supposed to mean?
Nothing. It's just that all men are sure it never happened to them, and most women at one time or another have done it, so you do the math.
You don't think that I can tell a difference?
No.
Get out of here.
Ooh. Oh. Ooh.
Are you okay?
Oh. Oh, God. Ooh, oh, God. Oh. 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 Oh, God. Oh, yeah, right there. Oh. 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 Oh, God. Oh. Yes. 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 Yes! Yes! Ah! Oh! Oh, yes! 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 Oh! Yes! 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 Oh! 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 Oh, God! Oh.
I'll have what she's having.
There it is. We are talking with David Thompson, one of the great scenes in movies in recent decades, Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan.
It's a scene everyone remembers. And as you said, I think it's probably, for most of us, it is for me, to remember the film well enough to give a detailed account of its story. I sort of have a vague sense. But the scene stands out. Of course, it's a great scene to listen to. It's a good scene on radio, but Meg Ryan does a fantastic job visually, too. And I think that, I don't think it was the easiest scene for her to do. And I think there's something fascinating about this scene, that it's a moment where a professional actress sort of has to own up to maybe something that amateur actresses do sometimes. And I think getting the level right was quite tricky for her.
I bet. I bet. Did you ever have a conversation with her about that?
No. But she's been interviewed about it. And she has said that it was not an easy scene to do. I think it's easy to understand why that should be.
David, you have caused me, by the way, any of the films that we are talking about, when you hear the clips, some of them, unfortunately, we have had to edit for time because they can last 7-8 minutes and we'd run out of time.
Yeah.
But the full clip you can hear on our website with photographs from the book, and that's at WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show, and you'll see David's book also. That's up there right now. David, this was such an interesting way to go at this, and you made me think, as we go through some of these movies, about whether it was writing, whether it was direction. For instance, just now I was thinking about Meg Ryan and Rob Reiner directing her, and what he might have said, whether it came mostly from her. Tell me, though, where did you or how did you stumble on this idea where you wanted to just do the scenes?
Well, it has very much to do with what I was just saying. If you spend as long as I have done thinking about movies, talking about them, writing about them, you will discover that people may have seen a film a very long time ago, 30 years, 50 years even, and a scene, a moment from the scene sticks out in their mind, and it's as if they can see it. It's as if in the act of remembering it, they run the scene on a projector inside their own mind. So that, for instance, I found often that people said, oh, the end of The Third Man,
mm-hmm.
where she walks out of the graveyard and she walks right past the camera. And if you say to them, well, why is she in a graveyard and what's the story about it? Who is the third man? People say, well, now, wait a minute. That's tricky. That's complicated. I'm not sure I remember it. And I think that what one's getting at really is that movie, when it's really great, it's a mixture of story, obviously, and the screenwriter has had a lot to do with it, and the actors have a lot to do with it, but it's the way the scene has been shot.
Mm.
And you literally, I think, if you treasure the moment, you really can bring it to life with the camera angle and everything else about it as it was really made. It isn't like a scene from a book that you remember just as a literary event. It's a cinematic event that you recall.
Uh-huh. Let's do another one. This is 1938, Bringing a Baby. This was directed by Howard Hawks, screenwriter Dougley Nichols and Hagar Wild, Katharine Hepburn as Susan, Cary Grant as David.
Now, please listen to me. You certainly can't think that I did that intentionally.
Well, if I could think, I'd have run when I saw you.
No, but if you'd only wait while I explain, I just gave you my picture. Oh, you've torn your coat. Well, Now, I didn't do it on purpose. Not right. That's not right. It's not my fault. I didn't mean to do it. I just did it. But I didn't mean to do it. I just caught hold of your coat.
Look, will you do something for me?
A needle?
No, it's simpler than that. Let's play a game.
Oh? What?
Well, watch. I'll put my hand over my eyes, and then you go away.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll count to 10, and when I take my hand down, you will be gone. One.
Well,
five,
I like
six,
that. I was only trying to be nice.
Thank you. Oh, just a minute.
Oh, no,
just a
you moment. Can't talk to me that way and then crawl out of it. When I'm mad, I am mad.
Something horrible has happened.
Well, don't tell me about it. Just get out of it as best you can.
No, no.
And please stop following me around, what? Fixation or no,
now,
fixation.
Will you please,
I've had about enough.
Please stop talking so that I
will
can tell
you. Will you please stop crowding me?
No. Look, I'm just trying to tell you that you've told.
Oh, no, I didn't. Why, if you hadn't been in such a hurry and had waited for my explanation.
Not my coat.
Your coat would still be perfectly all right.
Oh.
What is the matter with you?
Well, you see, I...
Do you realize that you're making a perfect fool of yourself? Now, look here, you can't tell me that I tore your coat. There's such a thing as being... Will you please stop doing that with your hat?
Well, just stand there, will you?
What in the world is going on
here? Oh, no, please don't move.
Oh, I've had about enough of this.
Now, look, listen to me. Let's get out of here. Just start walking. Believe
so now you want to walk. Well, I'm quite sure that I don't want to walk with you. And I hope you realize that you've made a perfect spectacle of yourself. Have you finished?
Yes.
Don't just stand there. Do something. Oh, my goodness. Well, get behind me.
I am behind
you. Get closer.
I can't get any closer now. Now, you ready?
Yes,
be calm. Left foot first.
All right. Keep going straight out the door.
Yes, but I have to meet somebody here. Oh, there he is.
Don't you dare leave me.
I'll be with you in a minute, mister. I'll see you in a minute.
You know, I probably, David, should have introduced this going in to explain the scene for people who don't remember Bringing a Baby. It's just a terrific movie. And, of course, not only does Cary Grant ruin his jacket, but her dress is...
Well, you might not pick it up entirely from just the soundtrack, but in their confusion... he has stepped on the hem of her dress. It's a full-length dress, which has torn off the back of it so that her panties are revealed. And she only realizes that some time after he's noticed it. And he protects her honor with a gesture that's quite sublime in the film. He puts his top hat against her rear end. And she thinks he's doing something extremely indecent, whereas, of course, he's trying to protect her honor, or whatever it is. And it is a superb farcical scene. And I think it's funny on the soundtrack alone, but when you see it, it still has audiences falling about.
Isn't it interesting hearing those two clips, Harry Met Sally and Bringing Up Baby, to hear how the style of acting has changed?
It is, although, you know, something I thought as we were listening to them, these are love stories in which the lovers quarrel a great deal. Love stories in which lovers simply tell each other how wonderful they are and how they adore each other and kiss all the time. There are films like that, but I think, in fact, the films that last better are ones where... through some confusion or something in their characters, they argue and they fight. And it's the whole principle that love is an ongoing, often quite belligerent conversation. And that's there in both those films.
We're going to take a quick break. And David Thompson, please stay where you are. But I want to ask you on the other side of this break whether the scene that to make a movie great has to be very over the top. How subtle can it be? So stay with us. We'll be right back. And then moments from the movies. Oh, I'm Faith Middleton. David Thompson, film critic for The New Republic, author of Moments That Made the Movies. We've excerpted some of David's favorite dialogue for time, but you can hear the entire scenes with photos right now at our website, WNPR.org. Click on programs for The Faith Middleton Show. So, David, to come back to this question, yeah. Does it have to be, we're going to get to Citizen Kane in a minute, does the scene have to be over the top? How subtle can it be?
Oh, I think it can be as subtle as anyone can make it. I mean, the genre of a film will affect everything. I was thinking about scenes of subtlety. There is a moment in The Godfather. It's a scene where Al Pacino and another character are guarding the hospital where Marlon Brando is after he's been shot. And they are both very nervous and very afraid. Mm-hmm. And the other guy is shaking. They exchange a cigarette. The other man's hands are all over the place. And Michael, the Al Pacino character, just looks at his own hands and he realizes that they are rock steady. And in that moment, and I think it's a very subtle moment, he realizes that he has got ice in his blood, and in fact, that he's exactly got the character that's made to be the leader of a criminal family. Now, if you tell people who believe they know The Godfather, if you mention that scene, sometimes they will say, oh, I don't think I remember that scene. But if you show it to them, oh, yes, I've got it. Yes, of course. It's a turning moment in the film. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you can have a turning moment in a film that is so well done, is so subtly done, you hardly notice it at the time, or you're hardly aware of noticing it.
The Godfather series is one of my all-time favorites. I have probably seen them all 10 times, and it's not until you spoke about this that I remembered that scene, and that is an amazing observation from you. Let's do Citizen Kane, 1941, yeah. Orson Welles, Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles, screenwriters. Let's see. We've got Buddy Swan as Kane. He's about age 8. We have Agnes Moorehead as Mary Kane. George Clouris as Walter Parks Thatcher, and Harry Shannon as Kane's father. Can you explain this scene we're going to listen to?
Yeah, this is in the sort of little house in Colorado where the Kane family lives. It's a boarding house, but it doesn't do very much business. And the family have inherited, as a bad debt, the deeds to a mine. And it turns out to be a rich, rich mine. And the mother decides that rather than let her son, Charles, stay in Colorado, getting nowhere, she will have him virtually purchased by a big bank, so that for $50,000 a year, I think it is, he will go east and he will be educated and he will be refined and he will be raised to be Citizen Kane, the most powerful person in America almost. And what we're seeing, what we're hearing here, is the scene where the banker comes to collect the boy. It's an extraordinarily brutal scene in a way, because a human being is sold, and is sold by his own parents. And of course it is at the heart of the problem the character of Kane has in understanding himself.
Come on, boys! We're Union Jack!
Be careful, Charles!
Kane.
Pull your muffler around your neck, Charles.
Kane, I think we shall have to tell him now.
Yes. I'll sign those papers now, Mr. Thatcher.
You people seem to forget that I'm the boy's father.
It's going to be done exactly the way I've told Mr. Thatcher.
There ain't nothing wrong with Colorado. I don't see why we can't raise our own son just because we come into some money. If I want, I can go to court. A father has a right to. A boarder that beats his bill and leaves worthless stock behind. That property is just as much my property as anybody's, now that it's valuable, And if Fred Graves had any idea all this was going to happen, he'd have made out those certificates in both our names.
However, they were made out in Mrs. Kane's name.
He owed the money for the board to the both of us.
The bank's decision on all matters concerning...
I don't hold with signing my boy away to any bank as guardian.
I want you to stop all this nonsense,
The bank's decision on all matters concerning his education, his places of residence, and similar subjects is to be
the
final.
The idea of a bank being the guardian.
I want you to stop all this nonsense, Jim.
We will assume full management of the Colorado loan, of which, I repeat, Mrs. Kane, you are the sole owner.
Where do I sign, Mr. Thatcher?
Right here, Mrs. Kane.
Mary, I'm asking you for the last time. Anybody think I hadn't been a good husband?
The sum of $50,000 a year is to be paid to you and Mr. Kane as long as you both live, and thereafter to the survivor.
Well, let's hope it's all for the best.
It is.
Why I can't raise my own boy is more than I can understand.
Go on, Mr. Thatcher.
Everything else, the principal as well as all monies earned, is to be administered by the bank in trust for your son, Charles Foster Kane, until he reaches his 25th birthday, at which time he is to come into complete possession.
Charles! Go on, Mr. Thatcher.
Well, it's almost five, Mrs. Kane. Don't you think I'd better meet the boy?
I've got his trunk all packed. I've had it packed for a week now.
I've arranged for a tutor to meet us in Chicago. I'd have brought him here with me, but...
Charles!
Lucky, Mom!
Better come inside, son.
Well, 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 that's quite a snowman. Did you make it all by yourself, my lad?
Maybe I'll make some teeth and whiskers.
This is Mr. Thatcher, Charles.
Hello.
How do you do, Charles?
He comes from the east.
Wow.
Hello, Charlie.
Charles?
Yes, Mommy?
Mr. Thatcher's going to take you on a trip with him tonight. You'll be leaving on number 10.
That's the train with all the lights on it.
You going, Mom?
Well, no, your mother won't be going right away, Charles, but she'll be...
Where am I going?
You're going to see Chicago and New York and Washington, maybe. Ain't he, Mr. Thatcher?
He certainly is. I wish I were a little boy going on a trip like that for the first time.
Why aren't you coming with us, Mom?
We have to stay here, Charles.
You're going to live with Mr. Thatcher from now on, Charlie. You're going to be rich. Your ma figures. Well, that is, me and her decided this ain't the place for you to grow up in. You'll probably be the richest man in America someday, and you ought to get an education.
You won't be
lonely, of course not. Why, we're going to have some fine times together. Really, we are, Charles. Now, shall we shake hands? Oh, come, come, come. I'm not as frightening as all that, am I? Now, what do you say? Let's shake.
Why, Charles.
Oh, Charles, you almost hurt me.
What's that on the table?
What's that to lay with?
Jim! I'm sorry, Mr. Thatcher. What that kid needs is a good thrashing.
That's what you think, is it, Jim?
Yes.
That's why he's going to be brought up where you can't get at him.
You know, before the show, David, we were all listening to this, and the hair stood up on the back of my neck. It's such a cruel scene.
Well, it's a very, very powerful scene, and I think a lot of the power has to do with the fact that it's never really explained. The mother there says she'll be coming along to see him later, but the film shows nothing of that. So effectively, it's the last moment he sees his parents. It's also the moment where the film identifies the key prop in the film, because there he is, playing in the snow with a sled. And I don't want to spoil everything for the film if there's someone who hasn't seen it, but that sled will play a very, very important emotional part in the film. And I think it's because the boy has never really understood what happened that day. And although we see it happening, it is so beautifully shot, and there's such a strong sense of this place that it stays in our mind in the way I think it would have stayed in the boy's mind.
What's interesting, if you look at the bringing a baby clip that we ran just a few minutes ago, and this Citizen Kane, because we're isolating the audio, we're not seeing the video at the moment, I'm struck by interruption in dialogue. And how that torrent of words, people interrupting each other constantly, the actors doing that, how much force that can have.
Yeah, well, It's an extraordinary thing about film, but you know, we are brought up to assume and take it for granted that the sound and the picture go together. But in fact, still to this day, the sound and picture are often made almost by different people. They're married together in the film, finally, but there is often a gap between them, and there is magic in that gap. And one of the reasons your hair stood on end in that scene is because of the music. The music by Bernard Herrmann, who was one of the great composers. He would go on, he would do a lot of Hitchcock films, he would do Vertigo, he would do Taxi Driver. Really one of the outstanding composers in film. And a man who had that knack of writing music that if you heard it in the concert hall, I think might sound melodramatic, but if you hear it with a film, it gives the film a depth that it just would not have otherwise. Mm.
David Thompson, film critic for The New Republic, author of Moments That Made the Movies. We've excerpted some of David's favorite dialogue for time here on the show, but you can hear and see. We also have the video at our website, so you can hear and see the entire scenes right now at WNPR.org. You can click on programs for the Faith Middleton Show. David Thompson, when you're in the movies, are you watching as a regular citizen, even though you're on assignment? Are you just letting it wash over you the way I do? Or are you do you have that sort of analyst hat on?
I don't know any regular citizens. All I know are people who go to the movies and have an extraordinary time. Mm-hmm. And I do the same. I've seen far too many films, and I've been doing it too long. But the fact of the matter is that every time the lights go down and the curtains open, I have an immense hope that I'm going to see one of the greatest things I've ever seen. If I do, if it is that good, and, you know, every year a couple of films at least come along that are in that category, it's because I'm going to be emotionally carried away. I'm going to be so caught up in it that I think I'm up there with the people almost. Mm-hmm. Or I know I will go home and daydream about it. Now, I'm a professional and I'm trained at it, and I think I'm quite good at watching how they're doing what they're doing. But what's happening doesn't mean a thing if the hair doesn't go up on the back of your neck, or if you aren't excited or frightened or amused or something like that. And I just don't think you can sit in the dark with a movie and not have that kind of feeling.
Now, don't think I'm saying that the whole is not important when I make this remark. But there are people, for instance, who are into baseball in terms of statistics. There are people who are into movies because of the movie making. And the story for these people, the moral import gets lost. Where are you on this spectrum?
I'm very old-fashioned in that sense. I was born in 1941, the year of Citizen Kane. I was shaped by movies in the late 40s and the early 50s. And movies in those days always told stories that they reckoned the audience could understand on a single viewing. Now, there are a lot of good films. Citizen Kane is one that you need to see more than once. Mm-hmm. But something needs to happen that first time that is so compelling that you are persuaded to go back. In other words, the first time you see it, you have to feel, I'm seeing something I've never seen before. I'm seeing a person or a situation or something that is just new. And there is that constant pressure in the movies to do something new. And if it doesn't work as a new story, and if you're not hooked because you want to know what happens next, then I don't think it's going to work. And the more that goes on, the more danger there is that the movies cease to be a great popular entertainment.
Well said. We have coming up Sunset Boulevard. We'll try to get to as many of these as we can. Anatomy of a Murder, Psycho, Bonnie and Clyde. I can't read a couple more. Heat and Burn After Reading, if we can get to them. I can't resist asking you, since you made that comment, every year there's a movie or two where I say, now that made the year worth it. Yes. We have the awards season just around the corner.
Yeah.
So have you got one or two that you think are going to do well or you wish would do well?
Well, whether they will do well, I don't know at all. I'll pick two. There is a documentary film called Stories We Tell that is in the running to be nominated as Best Documentary. And I will not spoil it for you, but there is a moment towards the end of that film where something happens that makes you realize that what you're seeing is not simply a documentary. It's more complicated. And I think that's a great moment. The other one, much more recent, and this was a really huge surprise for me, The Wolf of Wall Street reveals that Leonardo DiCaprio is an incredible comedian. Now, he's played an awful lot of very straight dramatic roles, and it's not that he doesn't do them well, but The Wolf of Wall Street releases, it liberates a kind of energetic comedy in him, a slapstick comedy that is just transporting, and I'm not sure that he should win the Oscar. I don't even think he'll get nominated, perhaps, but it is an amazing performance, and a very funny film, very, very dark film, but very funny film.
I'm going to make a kind of crazy prediction because I know the foreign press, so Golden Globes, I bet they're going to go for American Hustle.
They might. I think that film has a chance in the Oscars, too. A lot of people are having a good time at that film.
Oh, boy. Ferocious, ferocious performances. Yes. Okay, Sunset Boulevard, 1950. Billy Wilder directed this. Screenwriter Charles Brackett, Billy Wilder. And let's set up this scene, because I think this needs some setting up.
Well, it's the very opening of the film. And it's dawn in Los Angeles. And police cars are coming down Sunset Boulevard, their sirens howling, and a voice on the soundtrack, a male voice, friendly, worldly, starts to tell us what's happening and how we're going to one of the big houses and that something has happened, and in fact there's a corpse floating on top of the swimming pool. And what we learn, and it's one of the great coups in film history, is that it is the corpse that is telling us the story. It is a character named Joe Gillis, played by William Holden, the part that really turned William Holden from a so-so actor into a big star.
So this is you getting at how narration, the storyteller, that independent voice...
A lost art, I think, in film. Once upon a time, films loved voiceovers. They've gone out of fashion, and I think it's a pity, because I think it's something that both film and radio can do so well.
Yes, this is Sunset Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning. That's the homicide squad, complete with detectives and newspapermen. A murder has been reported from one of those great big houses in the 10,000 block. You'll read about it in the late editions, I'm sure. You'll get it over your radio and see it on television. Because an old-time star is involved. One of the biggest. But before you hear it all distorted and blown out of proportion, before those Hollywood columnists get their hands on it, maybe you'd like to hear the facts. The whole truth. If so, you've come to the right party. You see, the body of a young man was found floating in the pool of her mansion, with two shots in his back and one in his stomach. Nobody important, really. Just a movie writer with a couple of B pictures to his credit. The poor dope. He always wanted a pool. Well, in the end, he got himself a pool. Only the price turned out to be a little high. Let's go back about 6 months and find the day when it all started. I was living in an apartment house above Franklin and Ivar. Things were tough at the moment. I hadn't worked in a studio for a long time. So I sat there grinding out original stories, two a week. Only I seemed to have lost my touch. Maybe they weren't original enough. Maybe they were too original. All I know is they didn't sell.
Oh, let's all go to the movies tonight.
Yeah. This is,
what? That is perfect narration,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's got the tone exactly right.
Yeah, and you know, one of Holden's great qualities was the voice. When we think about movie stars, obviously they are good-looking, they are usually beautiful, they are actors of one kind or another, but I think the funny thing is that if you're from that era, you can recognize the voice in a couple of seconds. And if you don't have a great voice, then I don't think you became a star, really. The voice has to be crucial. And Holden, you know, that was not meant to be Holden. The original casting was Montgomery Clift, who would have made it a different kind of film. Maybe as good, maybe better. But Holden has a sort of easygoing, self-mocking cynicism almost that is perfect for that part.
Yeah, he's a kind of seesaw between
world-weary
and very interested, you know?
Yeah.
That's what's intriguing.
Yeah.
All right, David Thompson, stay exactly where you are. Can't wait to talk about more of these. Again, we've got the full clips and the video at our website, WNPR.org, and we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. It's a way to say I love you and enjoy fantastic food and wine in a beautiful setting. Join me the week of Valentine's Day for my fifth annual heart-to-heart dinner dance, February 12th at the Society Room, downtown Hartford, featuring a celebrated team of chefs working to make it a magical night for you, and wines from the gorgeous Frederick Wildman portfolio, music from Alex Nakamovsky, his vocalists and orchestra, special effects, lighting from Audio Media Solutions. The dress is festive, so up to you. Tickets are $90 per person to benefit WNPR and the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. Plenty of parking at the site. That's always nice. Our team of talented chefs includes David Sellers of Max Fish, Jeffrey Lazotte on 20, Brad Stabinski, Shamard Vineyards, Jason Sobozinski of Caseus, Jeffrey Crawford of Jordan Caterers, Stefan Drago of Bell Terrace, and Christopher Prosperi of Metro Beast. The menu is mouth-watering. This event sells out every time. Seating is limited. Of course, tickets, we'll give you that address in just a second. Special thanks to UConn Health Center's Pat and Jim Calhoun Cardiology Center and Fiddleheads. I can't wait to see you there February 12th. Go to WNPRHeartToHeart.org. That's WNPRHeartToHeart.org to be part of my Food Schmooze signature event. My guest, lucky us, David Thompson, film critic for the New Republic, author of Moments That Made the Movies. He has been looking at films and analyzing them for a long time, and we have excerpted some of David's favorite dialogue. We're listening to it here on the show, but you can hear the entire scenes with audio and video right now at our website, WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. We're going to do, Otto Preminger directed this, Anatomy of a murder. And David, I really enjoyed beautiful writing in your book. I enjoyed your analysis and why these things were important to you. And I appreciated the fact that you said, you know, these are personal to me, as this is the case with everybody who goes to a movie. And you know, your eyes or your ear, you catch something and it's meaningful. Probably not only for direction, but also because of what we bring to the film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, the thing that got me when I saw Anatomy of a Murder, I was 18. I had been used to movies, and particularly television shows, because Perry Mason had been going a couple of years. I'd been used to shows where when you went to the courtroom, you knew who was guilty and who was innocent. And Anatomy of a Murder was the first film I could ever remember that was like real life, where you don't know. And even at the end of the film, there's a verdict, but you don't know whether the guy did it or not. And that quality of lifelike doubt was riveting, I thought. And it's a very smart, very grown-up film altogether, beautifully acted. It has one of the great casts. It has Duke Ellington's music. And it has, for the second time in this hour, a pair of panties that play a crucial part.
And did you find anything there, any sort of evidence pertaining to the story that Miss Mannion had told you?
On the lane in the woods, we found some tire tracks and some dog tracks. And a leather case with some horn-rimmed glasses inside. We also looked for a certain undergarment of Mrs. Mannion's, but we didn't find it.
Will the attorneys for both sides approach the bench, please?
Mr. Bigler, you finally got your rape into the case, and I think all the details should now be made clear to the jury. Do you agree, Mr. Ludwig?
Absolutely.
What exactly was the undergarment just referred to?
Panties, Your Honor.
Do you expect this subject to come up again?
Yes, sir.
There's a certain light connotation attached to the word panties. Can we find another name for them?
I never heard my wife call them anything else.
Mr. Bigler?
I'm a bachelor, Your Honor.
That's a great help. Mr. Dancer?
I was overseas during the war, Your Honor. I learned a French word. I'm afraid that might be slightly suggestive.
Most French words are.
All right, gentlemen, back to your places. For the benefit of the jury, but more especially for the spectators, the undergarment referred to in the testimony was, to be exact, Mrs. Mannion's panties. I wanted you to get your snickering over and done with. This pair of panties will be mentioned again in the course of this trial. And when it happens, there will not be one laugh, one snicker, one giggle, or even one smirk in my courtroom. There isn't anything comic about a pair of panties which figure in the violent death of one man and the possible incarceration of another.
Such a funny line, huh?
Well, of course, it was also, I mean, it was being directed to the people in the court, but it was being directed to the audience in the movie theater, because in 1959, the word panties made most people uncomfortable. And I'm sure there are words today, I can't think of any, but I'm sure there are some, that still make us uncomfortable, mm-hmm. because we're never quite as grown up as we think we are. And so it's a device in the film that introduces the word and says, come on, shape up. You can take that word without going crazy about it.
Yeah.
The other thing that is so wonderful about that scene, I think, is that the actor had not acted before, the actor who plays the judge, he had not acted before. He had not even been a judge. He had been a lawyer. His name was Joseph Welsh, and he was the lawyer who had opposed Joseph McCarthy in the Army versus McCarthy hearings a few years before when they were televised. And he's really quite an heroic figure.
Wow. Well, the line that just cracks me up every time I hear it is when the actor says most French words are.
Yeah.
You know, I just thought it was the funniest thing. I thought, oh my God, who wrote this? I went back to say Wendell Mays.
Yes, but you know, don't you still think that a lot of us believe the French have slightly dirty minds?
Well, I think. That's like a no comment from me.
Right.
Okay. So let's do this one, because I certainly don't want to run out of time with David Thompson, who's film critic for The New Republic and author of Moments That Made the Movies. It's a very personally curated list from him. There will be things on here that will surprise you when you look at his book. There are so many more than we could possibly get to. Let's see. Laura, Meet Me in St. Louis, The Big Sleep, The Red Shoes, The Third Man, White Heats, The River, Place in the Sun, Strangers on a Train, Tokyo Story, The Bandwagon, A Star is Born, and on it goes. There are about, a couple hundred of these. But
people are going to have to buy the book.
Yes, that's right. Right. So the ones we're talking about here on the show, you can see all the audio and video at our websites. But let's do Heat. Let's move up in time. 1995, directed by Michael Mann, also the screenwriter. This is with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, the two actors everybody gets mixed up. So you want to set this up?
Well, they are opposing fighters in the great contest in Heat. One is a cop, Al Pacino, and one is a gangster who does big jobs, Robert De Niro. And they know that they are up against each other. And De Niro is trying to pull off a major robbery. Al Pacino is trying to stop him. And one night, Pacino has this brainwave. It's almost as if he was a great screenwriter. He thinks he'll invite the De Niro character for a cup of coffee, and they'll simply talk it over. It's a completely implausible scene, I think. I don't believe cops and gangsters behave like this in real life, but it's a riveting scene. And because it's Pacino and De Niro in the film, you know they've got to come together at some moment. There's got to be this meeting scene. And so this is the scene where they go to have a cup of coffee.
7 years in Folsom, in the hole for three. McNeil before that. McNeil is tough, as they say.
You looking to become a penologist?
You looking to go back? You know, I chase down some crews, guys just looking to fuck up, get busted back. At you?
You must have worked some dipshit crews.
I worked all kinds.
You see me doing thrill-seeker liquor store holdups with a Born to Lose tattoo on my chest?
No, I do not.
Right. I am never going back.
Then don't take down scores.
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best, trying to stop guys like me.
So you never wanted a regular type life?
The fuck is that? Barbecues and ball games?
Yeah.
This regular type life, that your life?
My life? No, my life. No, my life's a disaster zone. I got a stepdaughter so fucked up because her real father's this large type asshole. I got a wife. We're passing each other on the downslope of a marriage, my third. Because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block. That's my life.
Guy told me one time, don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around a corner. Now, if you're on me and you got to move when I move, how do you expect to keep a marriage?
Well, that's an interesting point. What are you, a monk?
I have a woman.
What do you tell her?
I tell her I'm a salesman.
So then if you spot me coming around that corner, you're just gonna walk out on this woman? Not say goodbye?
That's the discipline.
That's pretty vacant, you know?
Yeah, it is what it is. It's that or we both better go do something else, pal.
I don't know how to do anything else.
Neither do I.
I don't much want to either.
Neither do I.
You know, I have this recurring dream. I'm sitting at this big banquet table, and all the victims of all the murders I ever worked are sitting at this table, and they're staring at me with these black eyeballs because they got eight ball hemorrhages from the head wounds. And there they are, these big balloon people, because I found them 2 weeks after they'd been under the bed. The neighbors reported the smell. And there they are, all of them just sitting there.
What do they say?
Nothing.
No talk?
None. Just, they don't have anything to say. See, we just look at each other. They look at me, and that's it. That's the dream.
I have one where I'm drowning, and I gotta wake myself up and stop breathing or I'll die in my sleep.
You know what that's about?
Yeah, having enough time.
Enough time to do what you want to do?
That's right.
You doing it now?
Not yet.
You know, we're sitting here. You and I are like a couple of regular fellows. I mean, you do what you do, I do what I gotta do. And now that we've been face to face, if I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you. If it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're gonna turn into a widow, brother, you are going down.
There's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in? And I gotta put you down. Because no matter what, you will not get my way. We've been face to face, yeah. But I will not hesitate. Not for a second.
Maybe that's the way it'll be. Or, who knows?
Well, maybe we'll never see each other again.
David Thompson, film critic for The New Republic, author of Moments That Made the Movies. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
And special thanks to producer Jonathan McNichol. And also thank you to producer, senior producer Laurie Mack. As always, this show is about the richness of life in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton. Everything you heard on the show is up on our website right now, wnpr.org. Click on Programs for The Faith Middleton Show. Thank you.